This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up, the latest flood damage estimates in Minnesota. Minsure says, my bad. Another person sues the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis alleging abuse. And the city of Minneapolis wants to make it a little harder to run for mayor. It's Thursday, July 3rd. I'm John Wanamaker. Estimates of last month's flood damage in Minnesota now total $48 million. FEMA investigators are in the process of figuring out whether counties are eligible for federal aid. About half of Minnesota counties have released preliminary estimates of flood damage, and the numbers are expected to rise. Chris Idy is director of Minnesota's Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
We see what's eligible under the FEMA Public Assistance Program. Then we take all of that is eligible, and that is what we need to get to $7.3 million of damage in order for Governor Dayton to request President Obama declare us a major disaster here.
FEMA investigators are expected to complete their final damage analysis sometime next week. The State Department of Human Services failed to send out 16,000 notices to Minnesotans whose medical assistance applications are pending through Minsure. Elizabeth Stewicki reports.
The letters were supposed to notify applicants that they needed to provide proof of key information that the federal government couldn't verify automatically. Information such as income, citizenship, tribal membership, or Social Security numbers. The notices were supposed to go out beginning in February. And until Minsure receives that information, those medical assistance applications are on hold. Deputy Human Services Commissioner Chuck Johnson says the process just broke down.
It was human error. It was not having the right sort of project management oversight in place over all the processes that we had going on.
Johnson says DHS will send out those notices by the middle of July. He says many of the 16,000 have already been contacted through their counties, but he didn't have an exact number. He says consumers who think they may have been affected can call DHS or their county. Elizabeth Stewicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Department of Health says the number of abortions in the state dropped 7% last year. Mark Zadeklik has more.
The annual report says about 9,900 abortions were performed in Minnesota last year. That's the lowest number since the mid-1970s. Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life opposes abortion. Spokesman Bill Paler notes that the number of abortions has been falling over the past 10 years since the legislature passed the Woman's Right to Know Act in 2003. It requires abortion providers to provide certain information about the procedure 24 hours before it's performed.
It's great to see that more and more women are turning away from abortion and choosing to give life to their unborn babies. And we think that some of the pro-life laws that we've helped put into place are really making an impact.
Planned Parenthood, an organization that supports abortion rights, says expanding access to birth control options reduces abortion. Mark Zadeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A 75-year-old man is suing the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, saying a priest sexually abused him 60 years ago. The man was an altar boy in the 1950s at Guardian Angels Church in Hastings. He alleges he was 13 when the Reverend Alphonsus Ferguson first molested him. The lawsuit filed yesterday in Ramsey County alleges the Archdiocese knew Ferguson posed a risk but failed to protect children from him. Ferguson died in the 1970s. His name is not on the Archdiocese list of priests credibly accused of sexual abuse. An attorney for the Archdiocese says a recent review of files turned up no abuse allegations against Ferguson from his time in Hastings. The Minneapolis Charter Commission approved a ballot measure last night to raise the filing fees required to run for city offices. If voters approve the measure in November, the filing fee to run for mayor in Minneapolis will increase from $20 to $500. Last year's Minneapolis mayoral race included 35 candidates. Charter Commission Chair Barry Clegg says some Minneapolis voters expressed confusion about the bevy of candidates.
More than half of the candidates who ran for mayor in the last election did not file campaign finance reports. That means they didn't spend more than $100 in their campaign for mayor. And people who don't spend more than $100 and don't vigorously campaign are not viable candidates for mayor.
Opponents of the measure say increasing the filing fee will price out some candidates who don't have mainstream support. State law allows candidates to gather signatures in lieu of paying the filing fee. The ballot measure will go before voters on November 4th. And one thing we do know about the Twin Cities, it's a pretty good place to look for a job. The U.S. Labor Department says the Twin Cities region has the lowest unemployment rate of any major metropolitan area in the country. Matt Sepik reports.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says unemployment fell in all but 15 of the nation's 372 metro areas in May. The Twin Cities rate dropped to 4%. The figure, which is not seasonally adjusted, is the lowest of any metro area with more than a million people and a tenth of a point below second place Austin, Texas. Minnesota state economist Laura Kolumbakidis says other Minnesota cities have low unemployment, too. She credits the state's diverse economy.
Our employment is distributed across a wide range of industries. We're not a one industry or one industrial sector state.
Kolumbakidis says demand for workers in neighboring Iowa and especially North Dakota is also helping to keep the Twin Cities unemployment rate down. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Target's decision to ask customers not to bring guns to its stores is drawing mixed reactions. Martin Moylan has more.
The retailer has been under pressure to follow some other merchants and prohibit customers from openly carrying guns. In a corporate blog post that has drawn thousands of comments, interim Target CEO John Mulligan said the company will now, quote, respectfully request customers not bring firearms to Target. Rebecca Lowen, leader of the Minnesota chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, is pleased.
This is a huge step in the right direction. I am thankful to Target for actually paying attention.
But Andrew Rothman of the Minnesota-based Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance had a different take.
Target has made it clear that they're not going to enforce any sort of a ban, that this is a polite request, and we can handle that.
He says he would advise gun owners to be discreet if they choose to carry a firearm while in Target. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
North Dakota officials are asking a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit challenging that state's constitutional prohibition on same-sex marriage. Solicitor General Doug Barr argues in court documents that the U.S. Constitution gives states the rights to define and regulate marriage. Seven couples filed the federal lawsuit last month. A federal judge has given parties more time to review what documents could be unsealed in a secret investigation in Wisconsin. The question is whether Governor Scott Walker's campaign and right-leaning organizations violated campaign finance law. The judge granted a motion yesterday asking to extend the deadline to July 17th. The judge halted the investigation in May as part of a lawsuit the group Wisconsin Club for Growth filed challenging investigators' basis for the probe. The new light rail Green Line between Minneapolis and St. Paul saw a 16% jump in riders during its second week of operation. Curtis Gilbert has the numbers.
Preliminary numbers show last week more than 32,000 people boarded Green Line trains each weekday. That's 4,500 more people than rode each weekday during the previous week, and it's well ahead of Metro Transit's projections. The Nicollet Mall station continues to be the most popular place to board the train in Minneapolis, with Central Station leading in St. Paul. Ridership was up across the board for all the St. Paul stations. In Minneapolis, the Warehouse and Target Field stations saw fewer riders in week two. That could have something to do with the Minnesota Twins. The team had two weekday home games during the line's first week, but none last week. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And another transit news, Governor Mark Dayton is again urging the city of Minneapolis to make a decision on the $1.7 billion proposed Southwest Light Rail line. The city has until July 14th to vote on the project and has yet to schedule a hearing on it. It has been negotiating with the Metropolitan Council behind closed doors for the last 2 months. The parties have revealed little about the status of those talks. Dayton says a no vote from Minneapolis would be the death knell for Southwest Light Rail.
And then you're going to see public transit in the metropolitan area here snarled in a way that it hasn't rarely ever seen before, because you've got a project that so many people are depending upon that invested so much time and energy and forsaken other projects, buses or the like, for the sake of this one. If it stopped now, it'd be catastrophic.
The city council voted in March to oppose the plan to bury the light rail trains in shallow tunnels as they pass between Cedar Lake and Lake of the Isles. Dayton says while the project isn't perfect, the benefits far outweigh the costs. St. Paul will have 185 new car-to-go smart cars hit the streets on July 19th when the car-sharing service launches locally. The City Council approved an agreement with the company last month. St. Paul initially will charge $975 for each car. That yearly fee covers parking costs around the city. Josh Johnson is with Car2Go, which launched its Minneapolis fleet last September.
This is actually going to be the first cross-city market for Car2Go here in North America. So for Twin Cities as a whole, there will be 535 vehicles available for use.
There are two other car-sharing services in the Twin Cities, Zipcar and Our Car. Those vehicles are parked at specific spots. Car2Go allows customers to park the vehicles in most public parking spots, including non-restricted meters. South St. Paul's last remaining packing plant is temporarily closing, citing a shortage of cattle. The parent company of Dakota Premium Foods announced yesterday that the shutdown will affect around 300 workers, and they don't know how long it will last. The St. Paul Pioneer Press reports that a group of state lawmakers says they'll work with the company on a possible solution to the problem. A Brooklyn Park man accused of fleeing an accident and leaving his two injured children behind is expected to make his first appearance in Ramsey County District Court today. Peter Cox reports.
45-year-old Earl Ward faces charges of criminal vehicle operation, endangering a child, and violating a no-contact order. According to the criminal complaint, Ward jumped in the driver's seat of a van after his girlfriend got out. Ward drove off and soon crashed into a hole created by road construction on St. Paul's east side. The woman told police Ward was outside the van and his two children were crying and yelling her name when she first arrived. She ran to call 911. When she returned, Ward was gone. Ward's 14-year-old daughter had fractures in her spine. His 8-year-old son had a broken leg. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, microphones in remote Minnesota forests are giving researchers insight into the health of frogs. Scientists strap sound recorders on trees to track frog activity in the spring. Other devices monitor water and air temperature. Dan Gunderson reports from the Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge near Detroit Lakes.
Dozens of lakes and wetlands are scattered across this prairie and forest landscape. Biologist Lowell Deedy picks his way through the forest for about a quarter mile to a small wetland. It's one of 10 wetlands on the refuge where scientists started collecting data 7 years ago.
This is typical of a wooded pond on Tamarack Refuge, full of wood frogs, spring peepers, chorus frogs.
All those frogs are quiet now. Mating season is over. But it sounded very different 2 months ago. That cacophony was captured by a small electronic recorder. It looks like one of those wildlife cameras people strap on trees, but instead of a camera, it has microphones sticking out each side like ears. It records 5 minutes every hour, 24/7. It provides scientists a record of the activity of frogs, birds, and any other wildlife attracted to this marshy spot in the forest.
I don't know if it picks up mosquitoes or not. It seems like there's plenty of them around.
Lowell Deedy replaces the batteries and memory cards every 45 days from March to fall freeze-up. Analyzing the memory cards can tell scientists when frogs are first active in the spring and when mating season peaks. They can also get an idea of frog populations. Data collected from 34 sites across North America allowed researchers to quantify the decline in frog populations for the first time. They found that between 2002 and 2011, all frog populations were down nearly 4%. Species considered at risk fell nearly 12%. The study's lead author, USGS research ecologist Michael Adams, says he was surprised to find even frog species considered healthy lost population.
This measure of an overall decline in those species for the places that we're monitoring is the thing that really, I guess, was the most alarming in the study and that adds to our concern for what's going on with amphibians. There's still something else going on beyond what we knew was going on with the more critically endangered species.
Adams says disease, contaminants like pesticides, and habitat loss are primary reasons frog populations are shrinking. But he says scientists still don't understand why it's happening, and the why might be different in Minnesota than in Colorado or California. Adams says that's why long-term monitoring at sites across North America is so important.
It's unusual to have ecological research projects that run for a long time, and it allows us to ask types of questions that you can't normally ask over shorter time frames.
The information collected at more than 30 sites will help scientists see a big picture of frog populations and climate change, but it will also help better identify changes happening at each location so managers can try to reduce the effect on wildlife. Biologist Lowell Deedy strides through waist-high grass as he returns to his truck with another set of memory cards that hold a soundscape of life in a wetland.
This data here is one element to a much larger data collection process that's ongoing.
Besides the on-the-ground information, scientists monitor satellite images to track snowmelt and when the landscape turns from brown to green each spring. Deedy says biologists are looking for signs of seasonal changes.
How that changes behaviors or the life cycles of the insects and how frogs respond to that, how wetlands respond to that. Without gathering the data, you're not going to be able to really tell.
Deedy says he's noticed fewer spring peepers calling here at the refuge over the past 10 years, but he's not ready to blame that on climate change. He says it will likely take many more years of data for scientists to begin understanding the complex changes happening on the landscape. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News on the Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge.
And that's the NPR News update for Thursday, July 3rd. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.